Welcome to the War Report on Public Education. The future of education is an important concern for our time. Where it's heading, how it's evolving, and the influence corporate America has on its outcome. The War Report on Public Education provides critical news, analysis, and perspectives on the what, why, who, where, when, and how of both the new corporate state elites campaign, the Machiavellian agenda to destroy the nation's public education system, and the rising public resistance movement to defend and defeat this Machiavellian agenda. And now, here is our host, Dr. James Avington Miller, Jr.
Well, good afternoon, everyone. And for those of you who are just joining the show, welcome. And for those of you who've been around for a while, also welcome. Last time out, I tried to go through some of the more important school reform movements that have taken place over the past 150 years. And in doing so, I try to give you a sense of how the movement started, what precipitated the movement in terms of what crises, and what the movement was asked to do, and how the movement or the school went about trying to fulfill the requests that it was asked to do, all for the purpose of trying to, again, give you a sense of awareness of what has been happening in public education over the past 150 years. I'll repeat myself here. I believe that it is very critical for everyone to have not only an awareness, but a critical awareness of what public education has been going through and past and what it is going through now. This critical awareness hopefully will lead to a critical understanding, and from there, it will hopefully motivate individuals to do something as whatever they can in terms of voting, contributing funds, et cetera, to efforts to save public education in America, as opposed to what is happening now, the destruction of public education for the purposes of erecting a private national system of public education. And again, I believe if you understand or you are aware and then understand the history of public education in this country, hopefully you'll be more likely to get involved on one side or the other of this war that I will be talking about over the next coming week. I left off last week. I'm sorry, I keep thinking it was last week, 2 weeks ago, talking about the Sputnik affair. I hope you guys remember what I was saying about the Sputnik affair that took place, I think it was 1957, when the Russians put a spaceship in orbit with a monkey inside, and the ship circled the Earth and came back, and the monkey was alive. This event, as I said last time, sent humongous shockwaves through the American public. If the Russians could do that, they could also then send missiles, atomic bombs, atom bombs, hydrogen bombs to New York, Chicago, California, and we would be in deep trouble. Okay. But there was something else that's very important about that event. When the Russians sent Sputnik up, Americans, and particularly politicians, started looking to see how and why they were able to beat us. And they concluded that our public school system was a massive failure. They actually blame the public education system in this country for the Russians beating the U.S. to outer space. I don't know how they could arrive at that, but they did. It was real in their, I don't know if it was really real in their hearts and their minds, but they made it a real issue. Public education had fallen behind quality-wise the Russians and other countries, and that it was the fault of teachers, schools, school districts that had gone lax, had abandoned their role of providing a quality, rigorous, comprehensive program, educational program. And as a result, the Russians, who put more effort, more money, and emphasis on education, had a better education system that allowed them to leapfrog us in terms of science and technology. If our system had not gone lax, this would have never happened, and hence it was the fault of public education. I emphasize this for one important reason. For the first time, probably in almost 150 years, public education had gone from being the go-to public institution to find solutions, solve social problems, and do a job that no other public institution or private institution could do. It was truly the white hat institution. Almost overnight, it became the villain in this scenario. A major 180-degree turnaround. I want to, at the end of this show, get back to what I just said, raising the question of how exactly did public education go from being the go-to solution agency to the big bad threat to the nation in one fell swoop. With that in mind, I thought it would be more instructive to complete what I was talking about last week in terms of most important educational reform movements that have taken place over the last 150 years. I had mentioned the mother of all ed reform movement being the Common School Movement, the first one. Subsequent movements included all the way up to the Civil Rights Movement that involved education and the Brown versus Ferguson decision from the Supreme Court, or Brown versus Topeka is under three different names. And what those movements' aims were and how all the social movements in the past pretty much were geared towards improving the quality, the purpose of public education for the general population. Well, there were two movements that started after Sputnik and had a very sort of low-key presence, but took off in the 90s, the 1990s, and gain momentum after 2002 under the Bush 2 administration. And those two movements were different in tone and in structure and in purpose. And those two movements set the structure for where we are today, and a third movement that combines the two movements I'm about to talk about in a moment. The two movements were called, one was called the Standards Movement, and the second was called the Choice Movement. The Standards Movement basically sought to improve education within the existing structure of the public education system. Pretty much like past reform movements that sought to improve education rather than radically try and change it. What the Standards Movement was about, the people who were part and parcel of the Standards Movement saw what they thought was a major crisis, pretty much related to what people saw after the Sputnik incident. They felt that the school had lost, public schools in America had lost their focus. They had gone astray in the sense of trying to do so many different things to accommodate so many different segments of the population, minorities, women, poor, immigrants, and on and on. They felt that the public school system needed to come back to the basics, which they called it a core academic and curriculum focus. They felt that we were too soft on our students. We didn't challenge the student. We expected very little from the students. And as a result, students were coming out of school totally unprepared to function in the workplace and to help keep America a dominant economic force. So they said that what we need to do is go back to the basics in the form of math, reading, writing, and then adding science and, where available, computer technology. These are the things that would bring us back to prominence, and we needed to implement this set of changes immediately and comprehensively. That was for the elementary, middle school, and the high school. They also were seeking higher standards for higher education. Again, same argument being that people were coming out of college not too well informed, lacking knowledge and skills necessary to get a position of importance in the new market economy, and so that we had from top to bottom a problem. And then they sought support for the standards through the political structure so that these standards could become national standards, and if they were implemented, they would be the solution to yet another crisis. This phase of the Standard Movement we'll call the Standard Movement 0.10. It was all about social efficiency. It was the idea of you have to push your students through a rigorous curriculum, eliminate the arts, eliminate history, even PE, anything that was not directly tied to making students learn a comprehensive core set of standards that would improve their job perspective for the country. Now, that's kind of a lot, and I'm sort of going over some things that I said previously, but I'm trying to put them in a more coherent, organized, focused set of principles so that everyone will hopefully be on the same page as relates to these standards. Well, the standard movement 1.1 didn't go over as well as they thought it would. It didn't quite bomb, but it wasn't successful. So another movement started. And this movement was called the Choice Movement. Like the Standards Movement, it sought to make students learn more of what would be the essentials, the core knowledge needed for each student to take his or her place in the new corporate economy that had started back in the late 1800s and had taken off like gangbusters during World War I and World War II. So here you have two different movements, not at the same time, not necessarily competing, but both seeking to have a very dramatic impact on reshaping the American public school system. With that, we're going to take a short break, and I'll come back with more details about the Choice Movement 1.1, because there are two versions of this movement. So see you in a few minutes. Okay, we are back. I'm going to go to, as I said before, School Choice Movement 1.0. This movement sort of got its start in 1962 when an economist, a Nobel Prize-winning economist, Milton Friedman, published a book called Capitalism and Freedom. In that book, he had a chapter that basically outlined what capitalism and freedom meant for public education in America. And it gave people who thought like him, believed like him, inspiration to mount a new movement, the school choice movement. But the movement didn't do very well. It got a benefit from another book that came out in 1990 called Politics, Markets, and American Schools. This book and its authors would have a far more impact on getting their vision of what public education in America should be. And they actually were able to recruit a large number of converts. Their argument, but now this was School Choice Movement 1.0. They were successful, but not very much so, which would lead to School Choice Movement number 2. Just to let you know what was coming. All right. Their argument that they raised in favor of school choice consisted of two key elements. One was they use scholarly / research literature on school effectiveness that showed that schools were more effective at promoting student learning if they had the greatest degree of autonomy. If the schools had the greatest degree of autonomy in administration, teaching, and curriculum. Now, that may sound slightly familiar. Deregulation, which is really big and has been big for decades in this country, the deregulation of businesses and institutions so that there would be a free market that would regulate itself. Well, this is part and parcel of the ideas that gave birth to capitalism 100 years before this movement started. The second idea was we need to shift from democratic control to market control of schooling in order to make schools more educationally effective. Listen to what I just said. Shift away from the democratic model of schooling to a market control model of schooling. If we want to make education effective in this country, this is what we must do. You see a problem here? Schools are ineffective, what we say today, failing, and thus the only way to save schools was to take them out of the democratic control model and put schools in the hands of private enterprise. This was radical. It was so radical that they had a hard time convincing a large segment of the population that their views were good for students, good for parents, good for the country. People weren't buying it. Some people did, but in the main, the ideas were too radical. So the choice movement didn't do well. And it was mainly because of the rhetoric, the tone, the use of words that frightened most Americans. When you start talking about you're going to take a pro-democratic system and turn it into a private system. Now, this was back in the 90s. Remember, it got its start in the 1960s, didn't do well, got a push in 1990. But even for that period, it was too radical of an idea. So it pretty much failed. And in making their argument, they said things like, our guiding principle in the design of the choice system is that public authority must be put to use in creating a system that is almost entirely beyond the reach of public authority. I'll say that again. The best use of public authority would be to create a system that is almost entirely out of their reach. You hear that? Self-destroy yourself by creating a system that will replace you. In contrast, democratic control espouse views and values that the choice movement didn't even consider. And the values of democracy, the values of social equality, the values of freedom were not being expressed in the choice movement. And so that was one of the reasons that this movement tanked. So you have, by the 1990s, two new movements, the Standards Movement and the Choice Movement. They both tanked, but they would come back. They would come back with a new veneer that would make them more acceptable to a larger segment of the population. They would, like, pretty themselves up to some extent. Back to the Standards Movement, since it was slightly ahead of the Choice Movement. The Standards Movement 2.0 sought to broaden the base with a political appeal to equal opportunity. They didn't have that before. But once they wised up and changed the rhetoric, there was a change of profile for the movement. In the start of the 21st century, I'll say this, both Sanders and the Choice Movement, they both shifted their rhetoric, incorporating the language of equality, and guess where they got it from? The Civil Rights Movement. Yes, they co-opted the main theme of the Civil Rights Movement, which was a political theme, into their position. It worked. A change of strategy that worked. They were able to get more people involved and joining their movement and pushing the movement than they had previously. Something else happened also. The Standards Movement 1.0 was working from what I mentioned very briefly 2 weeks ago, a nation at risk. This was a report issued by the federal government, a report that was put together by, quote, some very distinguished individuals who were charged with the duty of assessing the quality or the status of public education in America at the time. And what they came out with was, we're in trouble. We are a nation at risk. And that risk was an economic risk. And that risk was such that it posed a danger to the security of the nation. That's some pretty heavy words. Education is in trouble, and the troubles are tantamount to putting a whole nation at risk, causing the nation to fall from its perch of economic dominance, all being laid at the foot of public education of the times. I say that slowly because I really want you to get it. It too was a report that laid blame on the crisis at the doorstep of public education. We had the Sputnik incident. Now we have a nation at risk. What the nation at risk did, though, it sort of supported the educational standards and accountability movement on the grounds of social efficiency. They said that if we adopt nationally the standards and accountability principles that the people who are pushing the standards movement are pushing, they will solve our problems. Well, folks, many people bought that argument, particularly governors and state legislators. They passed enabling state and local laws. But the U.S. Congress didn't buy it, and the larger segment of the general public. They kind of thought, well, you know, the ideas of some tough, rigorous standards are okay, but the government should not be pushing for national standards in curriculum, testing, hiring and firing of personnel. That's a state and local district job. And those entities should not be dictated by the federal government. So the standards got a boost from a nation at risk, but not enough to make it the dominant framework for changing public education. As a quick aside, it was a smart move on their part by incorporating a political theme hijacked from the civil rights movement. I also said, I think the last time out, that when you understand the various school reform movements, you will see that there were two programs, and I just now named them, school choice, school standards, that would learn from previous school reform movements. They would seek to avoid the mistakes that previous movements had made that led to their failure, and they would try to present themselves in a way that the more successful movements had presented themselves. And they succeeded when they adopted the plank from the civil rights movement. So that was smart, in my opinion. They married the standards movement with the civil rights movement. Just remember that. The standards movement later on would get another major, major boost from something called No Child Left Behind. National federal legislation signed into law by Bush 2 that for the first time put the federal government deeply involved with setting standards from the national position, somewhat invading states and local districts' rights. But it was a piece of legislation that people from both sides of the political aisle, Republicans Democrat, conservative, liberals support it. They trickle down to the governors and state legislators, and you have then a rebirth of the standards movement. The standards 2.0 got life popped back into it. They were still, well, this was because, and I'm going to go into No Child Left Behind and another on another show, because it is the most monumental piece of legislation to change the face of public education in this country in the past 150 years. It's huge, and it deserves its own show or a large part of its own show. So let me recap. This, from the standards movement, they were able to focus on rigorous academic subjects, core curriculum for all students, and high-stakes standardized testing and accountability. Pulling from the civil rights movement, the urgent call to reduce social inequality by increasing educational opportunity. And voila, they were kind of like off and going. Well, now we switch over to the choice movement, choice 2.0. And I see my time is beginning to run a little bit. Let us take a very short break, and I'll come back and wrap up these two movements and pose a question to you to think about in our absence. Okay, we are back. Moving to the school choice 2.0. It too was received a boost from a book. In 2005, a new book, an approach to the choice movement was introduced. The book was called Getting Choice Right, subtitle Ensuring Equity and Efficiency in Educational Policy. I'm going to say that again. Getting Choice Right. We didn't get it right the first time. We're going to get it right this time by adding Ensuring Equity and Efficiency in Educational Policy. And do you know it worked? By adding Ensuring Equity, changed both the tone and the value of the choice argument. Instead of being seen as a threat to social equality, choice now could be presented as a way to spread social opportunity to the disadvantaged. This shift was a shift in rhetoric. The rhetoric of equal opportunity drastically changed the way choice argument was received, and it also transformed the political complexion of the movement. They learned. They learned that for a movement of this magnitude to be successful, you had to add an acceptable political theme. They, too, stole from the civil rights movement by adding equal opportunity to the argument, help broadening the appeal to thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of more people. Again, I'll stress this point. They studied history, and they benefited from knowing what they had done wrong and what they needed to do to right their ship and have a chance of having their movement get started and be successful. I mentioned that at least a half a dozen times in the past when I cited Edmund Burke. Those who don't know history are doomed to repeat it. These people knew history, and they used that knowledge to craft some dynamite strategies, and implementing those strategies to the point of being very successful. Just wanted to get that in one more time. The Standards Movement, it would become very successful. You could almost say mission accomplished, like Bush did when he stood on the deck of the aircraft carrier and proclaimed that the Iraq army had been defeated and that the mission had been accomplished. You can almost do that with the Standards Movement. Even though it hasn't been in existence a little more than a decade or so, the Standards Movement has seen many of their core principles, values, incorporated into today's educational environment. That's pretty good. I don't like it, but that's pretty good in terms of making an objective statement. And like the Standards Movement, the Choice Movement folks would do the same thing, but they couldn't say mission accomplished. They could say mission in motion. We're moving. We got great movement. We are kicking butt, but we're not quite over the hump to the point where everything that we wanted or everything, our core principle, has been fully adapted. So let me tell you what these movements sought to do. For the Standards Movement, their goal was to increase administrators at the local level, schools, school board, control over one, instructions, the curriculum, reducing the autonomy of teachers. And when you combine those three goals, what you end up with is what we have now, a high stakes testing, the movement towards a national curriculum, and some outlandish accountability measures. They argue that standards set the state learning, let me say it again, standards set state learning for each grade and each subject. The standards set testing as a major instrument to determine the extent to which students have learned the material and sufficiently advanced their knowledge. And three, when you combine all the goals of the Standards Movement, what you get was a system that would hold both students and teachers accountable for accomplishing learning goals. Remember this, the Standards Movement, the most important principle was testing. Testing was the key, or what I like to call the linchpin. Because with testing, and this is what they were aiming for, with testing, they said we would motivate students and teachers. What they really meant was we would scare the hell out of both students and teachers. And that they would then worked harder at learning and at teaching, and as a result, they should both do better. And the overall goal of the standards movement would be mission accomplished. Turning to the choice movement, as I said before, they're moving. They haven't quite gotten to where their end game is, which I'll tell you in a minute what it is. But they have made a lot of progress, especially in the last 10 years. What their basic argument was the current structure of the system is public schools, public education, is fundamentally flawed and need to be replaced. Not improved, not massaged, not tinkered around the edges, needs to be replaced. And what was needed was to do away with democratic elected school boards because they were inherently ineffective and inefficient. They were also non-responsive to the educational consumer, which under their vision, students become educational consumers. Parents become educational consumers because it is consumers that support the market, the free market. So you have what they sought. The second thing was they sought to create schools outside of the framework of traditional districts and free from political intrusion and administrative constraints. That goes hand in hand with the first principle, where they wanted to do away with democratic elected school boards. What was really going on, what they wanted, and oh, they also felt that the only way that they could achieve their objective was through charter schools, vouchers, with vouchers being issued to students or their family, and these vouchers would be based on a per student amount or rate equal to or more than what districts or states provided for the public schools, and that students could take these vouchers to any school, another public school or a private school, including religious schools, military-style academies. It didn't matter. What mattered was the students would be free of the public school system and would be able to seek out school of their choice, and they would have the money to pay for it given to them by taxpayers. They also felt that given what they were trying to do, create a market-based education system, that schools needed to be lean and entrepreneurial organizations. I'll say that again.
2 minutes.
Schools needed to be lean and entrepreneurial organizations. Think McDonald's, think Walmart. What the school choice movement really wanted to do was to destroy public education and erect a national, corporate, privatized education system. They are on their way, and that's what the war that we'll be talking about in the future is all about, stopping the privatization of the public school system. Well, I've gone very close to my time limit. I want to tell you that starting with hopefully our next show, we're going to start doing series, one or two, maybe three shows on a very important issue in the war. I will have guests, some of the most prominent scholars, practitioners in the country, and from across the globe. I'll tell you more about that at the beginning of the next show. I ran out of time. I'm sorry, because there was a question that I wanted to raise and want you to think about, but I'll start the show next time with that. Have a good day, and come back in 2 weeks.
Join us again next time as we explore and become aware of the most pressing problem of our time, education, corporate America, and their unholy alliance.